This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation on our website, wnpr.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can always call us to talk about the week's news at 860-275-7266. There are cameras galore today. We're on Facebook Live, and you can find us there on the WNPR Connecticut Public Radio page. The cameras of CTN are also back with us today, so there's a lot of people watching us as well as listening to Colin McEnroe. He's the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Great to see you, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
And Liz Karandowitz is here. She's a Republican political analyst. Hello there, Liz.
Good morning, sir.
And Susan Raff, chief capital reporter for WFSB Channel 3. Hello there, Susan.
Good morning, everyone.
So we're going to be talking about third parties to start, and we don't usually do that, but we're going to talk about them because it was an interesting weekend in which Connecticut's Independent Party decided to pick Bob Stefanowski for their line. It's not as though all 25,000 or however many members of that party showed up to vote for it. About 43 people made the decision, and Bob Stefanowski got this line. Here's our friend Max Reese at NBC Connecticut discussing the number of votes that cross endorsements like the Independent Party or maybe the Working Families Party have generated in previous elections.
These cross endorsements come with sizable vote totals, too. 4 years ago, Governor Dan Malloy won more than 24,000 Working Families Party votes, while Republican Tom Foley won more than 22,000 Independent Party votes.
Okay, so, Colin, we don't talk about third parties very often. We are going to be talking about Oz Griebel making a unaffiliated run of his own in just a couple of minutes. But when we talk about these parties like the Independents and the Working Families Party that cross endorse, as our friend Max just said, there's a lot of votes at stake there. But does it really matter that people get a second ballot line, Bob Stefanowski or Ned Lamont?
I first of all, I don't know. And I spent quite a bit of time last night on this, thinking about this and crunching some numbers and stuff. And I would consider that to be time largely wasted in my life, unless Liz has some exit polls or something like that. I think it's going to be very hard to know. It's hard to know what's happening when people vote on these lines. A little easier to tell with working families. Independent Party is a party which has either lacked an identity for a really long time or had multiple identities. It really is like a multiple personality disorder party. So it was actually created by and for Ralph Nader originally, and I don't think it bears much of a resemblance to Ralph's original policies. Kind of gets hijacked for different purposes. There's this other overlay of problems, which is that when people enroll or register to vote and register for the Independent Party, some percentage of them clearly think they're registering as unaffiliated voters.
Yeah.
They see that word independent. And we know this. I mean, it's not just speculation. We know this because when they try to switch parties for the purposes of voting in a certain primary, they often run into problems because if you're really unaffiliated, you can switch essentially at the last minute.
And we've been hearing from a lot of those people, Colin, when we've talked about voting and how hard or easy it is to vote in the state. A lot of people have called us up and said, look, I've had a hard time actually registering, and that's because they are independent and not unaffiliated.
Right. So what's happening when somebody votes on that line? And this is the part I really don't know. So 2010, Tom Marsh, who's a pretty good guy and, you know, smart guy, not some gibbering idiot or something. He got 17,600 votes on that line. I don't really know what that meant exactly, but that's probably – there's some kind of ham sandwich number, right? You put a ham sandwich number on that line and it gets X number of votes. I don't know – and I don't think that those votes necessarily come exclusively from people who are registered independent because I don't think 22,000 registered independents voted in 2014. So I don't know who they are. They're people who don't like voting on the party line.
Right.
They see Democrats.
Yeah.
Republican, they say, I'm not going to do that,
right.
You know, and so Foley goes up to 22,000, and I don't know. I mean, I think these are a lot of people who just they don't like voting on the party line. They don't like either political party.
Well, in 2010, it did make the difference. I mean, there was a 6,500 deficit total for Tom Foley, and Tom Marsh had 17,600 votes. If Tom Foley had gotten cross-endorsed by the Independent Party, would that have made a difference? Because I think there are people who are seeking out another line. They don't want to vote for the Republicans. And frankly, on the Working Families Party line, a lot of those folks are people who are not necessarily registered Working Families Party voters, mm-hmm. but they're people who are seeking out another option. They don't want to vote for Democrats, even though they know that it's the Democrat candidate. and sometimes, you know, I think that's just wanting another option. Mm-hmm. And that's really what it is. But it did make a huge difference in 2010. And you know, I think obviously Tom Foley got wise to that and decided, you know, to try and pursue mm-hmm. the Independent Party support in 2014.
But I think, Susan, one of the important things to this is, and Colin mentioned it already, the word independent actually has a pretty powerful connotation to people. There are an awful lot of unaffiliated voters in the state, and I have had people argue with me for years that that's just people who don't want to engage in the process or they can't make up their mind. No, in actuality, those are people who don't want to affiliate with either of the two parties because they think that they don't stand for anything that they want to stand for. And you see independent on there and sounds, that sounds like me, man. I'm independent. So this word actually matters.
Sure. I think people don't want to be pegged in either direction. They want to be maybe considered free thinkers. But I think the issue with the independent party is that how strong and successful an independent is, if people don't know they're independent, they're unaffiliated, that's a huge problem. I think they have an identity issue of coming out. And this may seem like a small issue, but very few people in the media, none of the TV outlets knew that there was a caucus or a convention this weekend.
Well,
it came as a complete surprise on Sunday night. I mean, so the word is, I mean, if the Republicans or the Democrats have conventions, the word is out. So
sure.
They're not reaching out to let people know, hey, this is what we're doing this weekend, and this is what.
Well, there's
important.
Been a very contentious court battle between
right.
the two factions, and I think you have some faction was probably a little bit more geared towards that than the other faction. So I think there was a court decision last week that really kind of threw everything for a loop. So it'll be interesting to see how that settles
right,
out
and
what
helping,
the result
them in any way. I
no.
talked to Michael Telesco, who is mm-hmm. the chairman of the Waterbury.
The winner of the
right
the,
and he said he didn't battle. Care who the winner was as long as it was an open process.
I'm right. sure he actually did care who the winner was, but I will just say, Colin, so we're talking about the Danbury faction of the Independent Party or the Waterbury faction of the Independent Party, not a total a large number of total votes, but to Liz's point, if you look back at 2010 and look back at 2014. Whether it's who gets cross-endorsed, whether Tom Marsh is on there, whether or not you have a petitioning candidate like a Joe Visconti getting on there in 2014, these small number of votes in tightly drawn races actually matter a lot.
They certainly can. And once again, I mean, I wish I knew better what's really happening there. For example, I think we could agree that it's not axiomatic that all 17,600 of Tom Marsh's votes would have just floated right over. I mean, who knows? Who knows what these people are doing? Who knows what they think, too? I will say, that just to go back to a couple of things we've covered, I do think one thing that needs to be addressed in this state is to have people better informed when they're registering what this means. So there should be a big sign up at the registrar's office saying the Independent Party is a party. It's not unaffiliated, blah, blah, blah. And since a lot of other kinds of interfaces are used, maybe you need a pop-up window at DMV or whatever, so that just people know. I mean, I think it's unfortunate that people are registering and not understanding exactly what they're doing. And as to this other part of this, the Waterbury versus Danbury thing, it has created a tremendous amount of confusion, and I don't even think it's over. I mean, there's some suggestion that Danbury will go to court again to try to block this result. Just to back up and just to geek out on this for a second, I think there are only four, what the law kind of calls them minor parties. There are four, I think, so-called minor parties, the ones we're talking about, Independent Working Families, Green and Libertarian. I think those are the only parties besides Republican and Democrat you can register with in Connecticut. If you show up and say, I want to register as a voter, but I'm with Connecticut for Dan Kosky, they won't let you do it.
I think people could get down to party with that.
Yeah. So another thing that also happens is that these parties become concerned about ballot position. They don't want to lose that ballot line.
Well, and that's what's happened to the Independent Party. If you remember in 2016, Dan Carter was the endorsed candidate by the Danbury faction for the U.S. Senate. And then the Waterbury faction nominated their own candidate. And essentially what happened was they crossed out the line. So that made it so that they didn't have a candidate on the
And again, just so that people understand, the reason that the Independent Party or the Working Families Party has a line, but a Joe Visconti a couple of years ago or an Oz Griebel now has to petition his way on is because the Independent Party and the Working Families Party are able to generate enough support to get a line
Correct.
The next time around.
Correct. And the point about, that you made about, the Joe Visconti and having alternative candidates that are on these ballot positions is that people want an alternative. And you see all that in the presidential, as an example, where people weren't happy with that either, sort of major party candidate. So they picked somebody else. The you know, with the Quinnipiac poll, you know, Oz is already polling at 4%. That's significant in terms of like what that will do to the sort of outcome in the race. I mean, that's a
right.
If you took just that line, Liz, that you just said in isolation, people would say, I don't know that Liz really woke up on the right side of the bed this morning. But I think in the context of what we're talking about, yes, it is significant, more significant than 11,000 votes or whatever Joe Visconti
got.
Right,
but
it's not really significant in terms
of
the overall race.
Well, but it is significant when you look at outcomes. It might not be significant in terms of the vote share, but it is significant in terms of outcomes.
Yeah.
Right. Well, look what Ralph Nader did. What was it, 2008? I mean, he gave the Independent Party state access to the ballot. I mean, I think he got, what, almost 3% then? So right. I think that's when the Independent Party people realized that they were, a force to reckon with, but certainly a party out there. But I think it's disturbing now, you know, 10 years later, that people still don't know if what party or independent means they're not affiliated. And a better job needs
last
to be
time,
done.
The last time we had an outside candidate sort of spoil an election in a big way was when Joe Lieberman ran with his own party and kept Ned Lamont from being a United States senator. So, you know, maybe we'll see the same outcome this year.
And I mean, just to raise the Colin, Ralph Nader banner a little higher here, there has always been a question: why can we not have some sort of organized third party or fourth party, some party that actually benefits from people's nausea about the two major parties, and we never seem to be able to get there.
Right. I mentioned this in the notes. I referred to this as in Dankosky land. There would be and you're completely right. I mean, Dankosky land is a much better place than the world we live in. I want to emphasize that. But
it's not as good as Candyland, but it's okay.
Right. I mean, part of the problem now is they cross indoors for multiple reasons. But one of the reasons they cross indoors is because if they put a ham sandwich on that line and they don't, I think you have to get 1% still to keep your ballot line. Don't hold me to that. That might not be true. But, you know, if they put a ham sandwich there, they don't get enough votes and they lose the ballot line, that's not so great. So if you're the Working Families Party, if you're the Independent Party, you have a high incentive to cross endorse in order to stay relevant that way, too. And by the way, these all go line by line by line. So Connecticut for Lieberman, to the best of my knowledge, only ever had a U.S. Senate line. Joe Lieberman obviously did well enough in 2006 to qualify his party for a ballot line, but it was only ever a Senate line. Although weirdly, it was for all Senate cycles, because I remember John Mertens, who was like way to the left of Lieberman, ran on that line in 2010, which it wasn't the same Senate seat, but you could run for U.S. Senate with Connecticut for Lieberman.
So let me just throw this out there in a different way. If people say that they want a third party, and we hear that all the time, right? People say we want another choice. So here you have at the Independent Caucus, where you have Republican Joe Markley making the pitch that, you know, don't vote in, for an Oz Greeball because he's not going to win. So I think that they're basically saying, you know, we're the Republican Party, and they're I don't want to use the word bullying, but kind of steering people away from that third option because they're saying, well, they're not going to win that Independent Party, so don't go there, don't endorse him.
I'm going to push back on that a little bit because I think it is about organization too, right? So you know, it's incumbent upon you to bring independents to the caucus to vote for you. And so if a Republican candidate wants to get cross-endorsed by the Independent Party and they bring enough people to vote for them, they're going to win. And if Oz Griebel or whoever else wants that nomination, it's up to them to organize people to show up and vote for them. I mean, that's a very basic principle of elections. It's what happens when you go to a major party caucus or convention. It's what happens when you go to a minor party caucus or convention. If you want to get elected, you have to bring people to vote for you.
And you have Ned Lamont, who got cross-endorsed by the Working Families Party.
Sure.
So
right.
You actually have whittled it down.
That's John's point, though. If this keeps happening, these aren't really independent parties, third parties, minor parties.
It's work. It's work to build a party,
I know you're talking about the reality of it, but I think John's point is real, too.
Heaven forbid.
Well, no. I mean, that's the political, mechanical reality. The there's a larger question here, which is, should there be some mechanism where you get a ballot line and you do something
but the infrastructure exists there, so go for it. Maybe if the if the court issue between the two independent party factions is settled, maybe that's what will happen. But it's hard to say. I mean, you know, these things don't just, you know, snap your fingers and
I think it
things
waters
change.
It down.
I think an important piece of this, though, is the Working Families Party really is also fractionalized in that at the top of the ticket, they will almost always cross endorse a Democrat, but they actually run real candidates in city council in Hartford.
They've had a significant impact on the local and legislative races.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that's an important thing to note. Let's actually move on to some Republican Party politics. Bob Stefanowski is counting on the Republican Governors Association to play a very active role in the race. As a matter of fact, the RGA says that this particular race is a top priority. They've already invested more than $2 million in a contest they call very, very winnable. So what exactly does this mean as someone is part of the Republican Party apparatus? When the RGA says this is very winnable, we're going to put our money and in efforts behind Bob Stefanowski, how does it help?
I mean, it helps significantly. It helps in terms of, you know, another voice as part of the conversation, talking with voters about, you know, what the outcome means for the state of Connecticut. Politically, you know, having the engagement of the RGA, you know, internally will no doubt help Bob legitimize himself with donors and, you know, grassroots folks who want to know that this is a competitive race that they can win. You know, I think the media enjoys knowing that this is a top tier race that people across the country are going to be looking at. You know, this is a big cycle for the RGA. You know, they have the most incumbent governors that they've had in history. It's a big national cycle. When you look at what's at play, you've got Florida, Ohio, Arizona, Wisconsin. I mean, big states with incumbent governors. And so for Connecticut to be sort of put in that mix is a really good thing. And I think it tells people that, you know, it's evidence of kind of where we are politically.
I'm wondering, Colin, about how the Republican Governors Association that is looking at all these big races in states in which, you know, the typical Republican might look a little bit different than the typical Republican here in Connecticut, about whether or not the national apparatus actually is going to work on behalf of Bob Stefanowski. And already I think Ned Lamont is getting some traction because Bob Stefanowski during the Republican primary had to say, you know, I give Donald Trump an A grade. I'm going to run ads with Donald Trump in it. That doesn't necessarily play so well with all those unaffiliated voters here in our state.
Right. Yeah, I think all of this falls into the category of we have essentially two very long months coming up during which these candidates will be defining themselves.
Are we at 68 days, I think? Who's counting?
And so, I mean, it turns out, looking at the Q poll, that a lot of people were paying attention to the primaries eventually. If you think 60, 65% is a lot of people. A lot of people, you know, have at least paid some attention to this race, but presumably they're going to tune up more the all-important unaffiliated block, or that it's not really a block, but that huge horde or herd of unaffiliated voters.
Maybe some independents.
Yeah, and independents are going to start looking at this. And I don't think anybody really knows. I mean, I assume we're going to talk about the Q poll and the SHU poll in just a second here, but I don't think anybody really knows. We got a snapshot right now from August of 2018. That's going to change a lot as these candidates begin to define themselves in front of the likely voters. And we'll see then. I'm kind of agnostic about what any of this means until we see how they run against each other.
Susan?
John, you said something just a moment ago. You said about the Trump factor. But I think things have changed in the last, 6 months. You know, prior to that, everyone was a big Kasich supporter. Very few Connecticut Republicans aligned themselves with Trump. But I think that's changed. You have Manny Santos, the former mayor of Meriden, who's a pretty conservative candidate who's running for the 5th Congressional District. He's been very out front and center talking about his support for President Trump and his policies. Stefanowski has. So I think things have changed in that way in the past few months that I see Republicans talking about that and not shying away from endorsing the
I'm
president.
Sitting, though, right across from a Republican who I think would have a hard time saying, I'm a big supporter of Donald Trump. I mean, what do you see in that?
You know, what's interesting is I think that what frustrates people in Connecticut especially is this idea, is the fact that around the country, so many of our colleagues and you know, people that friends and neighbors, they're benefiting from economic boom. And I think what's frustrating, not only to Republicans, but to unaffiliateds and Democrats and people who live here, is that Connecticut's been left behind in that economic opportunity. And so when you hear people talk about what's happening in D.C. and what Connecticut's losing out on, that's what they're talking about. I think a lot of people, regardless of their party affiliation, would disagree with some things come out of Washington and the White House. But I think what people really focus on here is we're being left behind, the economic opportunity that other states are benefiting from.
Which is interesting, Colin, because the last thing I wanted to get to before we take a break, though, is if the RGA is getting into this race and saying it's a top priority, the CBIA, the Business and Industry Association, which has spent money in the past trying to get people elected who say they're going to cut taxes, they're basically saying we're going to lay out of this one and not spend as much money as they have in the past.
Yeah, I'm a little confused by that. Let's just back up for a second. First of all, I actually don't think that Trump is much of a factor in Connecticut, except in two races. I think for Santos versus Hayes, I mean, Trump is the House of Representatives is going to have a lot to say about what happens vis-a-vis President Trump in the future. And I think it's a fair question to ask either candidate, but especially Manny Santos, in debates and stuff like that. What would you do if you were a member of Congress and President Trump fired Robert Mueller prior to the conclusion of the investigation? What would you do if he locked up a journalist? What would you do? I mean, I think those are fair questions to ask somebody running for Congress. I don't think anybody gives, for Liz's reason, a whoop in the high wind about Bob Stefanowski and Donald Trump. It doesn't really matter what the governor thinks of Donald Trump or what Trump thinks of the governor. The stuff that Liz is talking about, economic growth, is probably a lot more important. Gets a little bit more important in the AG area. Obviously, AG is standing up to Trump, so Tong will make it a big issue against Hatfield. Now, I would defer to one of the other panelists. I'm a little bit confused by what CBIA is doing, but it could be, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I'll tackle the RGA piece. I mean, I did work with RGA in 2014 here in Connecticut. We spent about $8 million at an independent expenditure PAC, in that race with Tom Foley and Dan Malloy. And from my experience, I can tell you that those decisions that are made, individually based on what's happening in the state. So, it's much less driven about Washington politics and what's happening in states. And that's why the RGA has been successful. And that's why state races have been so successful.
But what about the CBI piece of this? But you were just saying that the thing that people are upset about, Republicans and many independents and Democrats, that we don't have the economic opportunity here in the state. The CBI is all about that. That's what they say.
So that's
lower
what they're
taxes,
talking about,
more
right?
business.
I mean, that's what they're focusing is on the issues. And to my knowledge, the CBIA has never gotten involved in the governor's race or any statewide races. The effort that they undertook 2 years ago in 2016 was specific to legislative races and not to a statewide race. And so I don't think this is odd at all. And for them to decide to focus on issues, I think. But
they have a lot of influence.
They have a lot of influence. And Susan, when you're spending money on legislative races and you're spending money to try to capture the House or the Senate in the capital of Connecticut, you are de facto trying to shape what people are going to vote like on that line. I mean, that's just why you're spending the money.
Of course. I wouldn't disagree with that at all.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the influence of polls. We finally had a poll, and then we had another poll like a couple hours later. The Quinnipiac poll, the SHU poll. We're going to find out just exactly what those say to us and how reliable they might be with Susan Raff from WFSB Channel 3, with Liz Karantowicz, who's a Republican political analyst, and Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show here on Connecticut Public Radio. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news here with Susan Raff from WFSB Channel 3, Liz Karantowicz, a Republican political analyst, and Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
We're doing a show today about termites. Betsy Kaplan, my senior producer, has fallen in love with termites and regards them as these romantic wandering minstrels of nature who actually run around kind of replenishing the ecosystem in certain ways. They're wonderful for planet Earth and the great circle of life. At a certain point, I did point out that they will eat your house.
They actually will eat your house.
We're dealing with that part, too.
Okay, that's good. So termites this afternoon on the Colin McEnroe Show. 1 week from today, I'm going to be hosting a gubernatorial debate focused on issues related to the state's economy. It's in partnership with our friends at the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges, the Connecticut Mirror, and WFSB, Channel 3. It's going to be held at the University of St. Joseph in West Hartford. Unfortunately, after much back and forth with his campaign staff, Bob Stefanowski has declined an invitation to attend. We will be debating with Ned Lamont and Oz Griebel, who will be talking about in just a moment. I don't know how much these debates matter, Susan. I mean, as a political reporter, I mean, you watch the debates for great sound bites and maybe things that people say that you can, you know, use in the newscast. But what else do they mean?
I think they matter. And I'll tell you, I think that Facebook matters in this way because we're able to live stream these debates on the web. So people can watch them during the day and whatever they, you know, it's snippets. So I think that's important because not everybody is home at 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon or 6-7 o'clock. So I think it's important. I think it's better now that you have a narrower field of candidates. I think it was a little distracting when you had the five Republicans. So I think now that it's come down to...
Or the 9 or 10 or 12 or however many there were when we started.
I think they matter. I think it's important. I think that it's hard, though, this time. I think now people will start to tune in because people have had summers and been on vacation. So I do think they're important when it comes to learning about the candidates.
Bob Stefanowski told us, Liz, that he thought that a couple of days after Labor Day, just too soon for the first debate. That's why he's not doing
white
the debate.
You can't wear white to the debate.
Oh, that's why I'm wearing my white jacket
today. Wear white. You can still do it for another couple of days. I mean, you know, he has now committed to saying he's going to do five debates with Ned Lamont. There's going to be at least one debate that he says he's not going to take part in. In previous cycles, we've had a few more debates. I don't know, is he, you know, gauging this right? Should he be doing more debates, fewer?
No, I mean, I think if he weren't debating at all, I think that's an issue. But to sign up to do five debates, I think that's a lot of time and that's a lot of opportunity to vet ideas and talk about policy. And so, no, I don't.
Yeah, he avoided several debates on the onset before the primary. I think probably four or five, handful.
And that seemed to be to his benefit. Yeah. he won.
Yeah.
So you can't really
take
issue with that. What? I mean, I you know, debates are great, like you said. You know, for the opportunity to kind of get out there and talk about the issues. But, you know, sometimes
I see a similarity with Stefanowski that I saw with Tom Foley and their reluctance to leave Fairfield County to campaign and meet voters. I mean, Ned Lamont is everywhere. He's in Hartford and that area. So I think that could be a challenge for him outside the debates, coming north of Fairfield County and either campaigning or going.
Bob is from
places.
Madison, so right. Getting out of Fairfield County is not as much of an issue. But I mean, I think he has been a lot of places. It's just, you know, doing it in a different way.
Colin, we've done so many debates together and we've hosted them, we've moderated them, we've asked questions. We make such a big deal of them. How much do you think that they matter in a race like this?
They can matter. First of all, one thing you have to say is there's almost no such thing in the world of political debates as beginner's luck. And beginners tend to not be very good at debates. Ned, in 2006, the first time he debated Lieberman, he just, you know, had kind of a deer in the headlights problem, which actually turns out to be his common facial expression. but he didn't perform that well. Presumably, Lamont has had some time to tune himself up over a few cycles now. It might be one reason why Stefanowski's handlers are saying, you know, let's wait as long as possible before we have to jump in with this guy. Not that Ned is like William Jennings Bryan or anything, but if you've got a little of this stuff under your belt, it really does help you a lot. It's an unnatural environment. Most people think they're better prepared to do it than not. And now, do they matter? I think that they matter sometimes as opportunities, which are either seized or not. I would give an example of, you know, Linda McMahon in 2010 and in 2012, and she got better in between those two cycles. You know, she maybe had an opportunity there to ding Blumenthal, you know, if she'd showed up and just turned out to be really great at debating as a beginner. You know, she wasn't, so I don't think that those debates mattered that much. I think, you know, if you can land a knockout blow somehow, it can really help a lot. Or if you can change people's image of who you are in that debate, they can matter.
Well,
but
also,
a lot of times they don't.
It's also really interesting because in both 2010 and 2014, on the debate stage, Dan Malloy looked straight into camera and said, "I'm not going to raise taxes." And in 2014, he said, "I'm taking a pledge not to raise your taxes." And those are two clips that will live in infamy, right? Because he delivered two of the largest
tax hikes in state history. But to use your words back at you, Liz, he won, didn't he?
He did. He did.
I mean, I don't know what to say.
Absolutely.
I mean, he did won.
But the point is that, you know, when debates can, to your point, be about saying things and clips and how they're used. And so there are opportunities to sort of make a mistake, even when you're a guy like Dan Malloy, who's got a lot of practice and knows what he's
doing. Well, you can say all kinds of things on the campaign trail. And I think, you know, I mean, Bowden and Stefanowski have said they're going to get rid of the income tax. I think that's really stunned a lot of people. And we'll have to wait and see whether that really happens. I mean, you're talking about $10 billion of revenue.
Well, and we'll try to give the people who ask the questions maybe just a little bit of credit that hopefully with, as you say, a thinner field, we may be able to push back on either Ned Lamont's plan for taxes or Bob Stefanowski's plan for taxes. Anyway, the debate season starts next week. The poll season finally got underway. A few polls that happened at exactly the same time. One, the Quinnipiac poll, one, Sacred Heart University and Hearst Connecticut Media. Both were conducted August 16th through the 21st. In the Quinnipiac poll, Ned Lamont enjoyed a 13-point lead. It was much tighter in the other poll. Stefanowski, of course, says his own polling is more attuned with the one that comes from SHU. Here he is actually talking on AM 970. Don't know that station? That's because it's in New York. Here he is talking about this poll.
Quinnipiac is showing a much larger lead by your opponent, Lamont. You feel that it's coming closer to single digits?
Yeah, Sacred Heart did a poll that is in line with ours. Quinnipiac, first, has got a Democratic bent to it, so we think it's a little bit skewed. They don't survey likely voters. They survey people that are self-certifying themselves as registered voters. They surveyed more Democratic voters than they did Republican voters. Our poll, our polling has been right from day one. People didn't think we were going to win the primary. And John McLaughlin's polling was right on target. We won by 10 points. So I don't think we're ahead, but I think it's absolutely a toss-up right now. And when I get my message out there about tax reform, relative to what Lamont's going to do, we're going to win this thing.
Can I just say, Mike Francesa sounds terrible.
He needs
to get back together with Chris Russo.
The host, I don't know this host. Do you know who this is, Colin?
No, I don't know who that guy is. But the Quinnipiac poll is actually a very good poll.
Well, anyway, Bob Stefanowski spending valuable time talking to New York media about this. But, I mean, what do you make of some of the assertions he makes about the Quinnipiac poll and the veracity of the other one as well?
Well, first of all, I will say that John McLaughlin is a very good pollster. He's an internal pollster for Stefanowski. He's very good, and they're smart, and they know what they're doing. I think, you know, it's a little early for all this. The one thing I will say is we know the Quinnipiac poll. Stefanowski is essentially incorrect in saying that it has a lean. It's got an A-minus rating from 538, and its lean is down to like a percent of a percent or something. Its lean is almost invisible at this point. So as I looked at that poll, however, if I were Bob Stefanowski looking at that poll, one thing that would make me very happy is that Lamont is soft among independents or unaffiliateds, let's say unaffiliateds.
I'm sorry, yes, let's use the term correctly, Colin.
They say independents on the poll, but unaffiliateds. In fact, Stefanowski is running ahead of Lamont among unaffiliateds, both in terms of potential votes and approval rating and all that kind of stuff. That should make him happy. I mean, I think the poll assumes a certain turnout flow, you know, that Democrats will come out in greater numbers in a midterm election than unaffiliateds will. I don't know if that's true or not. Once again, I'm glad Quinnipiac is going to poll more because they're really good. They do really good polls. Their methodology is good, and their track record is very good. The SHU Hearst poll is a little bit more of a question mark. Heuristically, I sort of see things that kind of don't ring quite right inside that poll. Like I know that Dan Malloy is unpopular. I don't think 15.9% is the correct approval rating. It just doesn't really track well with other stuff. I will say also, I'm always troubled by the way polls get reported on. And Ken Dixon, I love you. You're a great journalist, and you do terrific work. But when he reported this poll, he said there was essentially a 4-point lead and a 4-point margin for error. I'm estimating here. He said so. Essentially, Lamont and Stefanowski are heading into Labor Day weekend essentially in a tie. Well, that's possible. That might be true. It also might be true that Ned Lamont is 8 points ahead, too. I mean, if he's 4 points ahead and there's a 4-point margin for error, they could be tied. He could really be 4 points ahead, or he could be 8 points ahead, and there's no way of knowing that. So I just wish when people report on polls, they'd be a little bit more careful about what they say.
Well, the Quinnipiac poll, they use live callers. We're going to get into like nerd stuff now. So
and bigger samples.
Yeah, they use they do 1,000 voter sample, and they did live calling, and so there's a little bit more of a reliability to those answers than when you do, automated or IVR and things like that.
Although the competence gap between the two methodologies is narrowing and narrowing, but it depends which.
Correct. Yeah. And so they're able to do the right mix of sampling between cell phones and landlines. And so from like a nerd's perspective on this stuff, like, you know, like you said, they're very reliable. Mm. But they did only sample registered voters, right? Not likely voters. And there is a little bit of a difference there. But you also have to remember, too, that Bob Stefanowski was coming out of a primary where there was millions of dollars spent with negative advertising against him. And so that does impact, obviously, the conversation, whereas Ned Lamont had a wide open field without anybody running against him in that process. So I think there's a lot of room left to make movement here. And I think the fact that, Bob came out of a pretty tough primary with 83% of support among Republicans, that I think that's a good thing because you need about 90% to win.
Well, I think he was negative as well. So I think it's a two-way street. But my question is, do polls really matter? And I always wonder about that because the candidates themselves will always say, well, what is it? It's just a snapshot in time.
Right, which is correct.
If you're ahead, they matter. If you're not, they don't.
Right. And how much does that weigh into the average voter? Do they say, well, if this person's ahead, then, you know, they must be the better candidate?
It's less about the voters, I think, and more about the structure of a campaign, right? I mean, if you've got some good polling that's compelling that shows that you're competitive and that you're in the lead, it helps raise money. It helps get volunteers. It helps to build a broader coalition. And so it opens doors for you that you may not open if you don't have a compelling case to say that there's a competitive race here.
So the polls are used primarily, or a bigger benefit is for the campaign itself, so that they can wage forward and get more money.
And that's why they'll talk about their internal polls, and they'll share those internal polls that might contradict the Q poll with those folks.
I will say we just saw an upset last night in Florida, though, where a Democratic candidate won in the Democratic primary, having never led in any polls. So sometimes the polls don't tell us anything in particular. I will just to put a little bow on this, Colin. Liz said that we were going to enter into nerd territory. I just wrote this line that you said, the competence gap between the two methodologies is narrowing. And I thought that was a good headline for the segment that we just went through.
Right. So, I mean, Nate Silver, who's sort of, kind of a go-to guru about all this, was very dismissive of online polling when he first started out. And he and his whole 538 operation now say it can be done very well. It can be done. Ultimately, the way you evaluate polls is how close to their actual results do they come. But I just want to go back to what Susan said, because this is really important that people don't understand it. It is. It's a snapshot of how things are in August. Yeah. It is not predictive of how things are going to be in November. And it gets more interesting when you have multiple polls and you can start connecting dots and drawing trend lines and seeing whether people are, as I always say, campaigns are about solving problems. So whatever your problem is, if you're Ned Lamont, are you solving that problem? Is your trend line going up? Same thing for Bob Stefanowski. This one poll all by itself, in terms of its predictive power, is close to useless, other than the fact that I think it sort of points to how hard it is for Republicans to win in this state with, registration disadvantage and stuff like that.
I want to just quickly say, if Ned Lamont's trying to solve problems in his campaign, he's coming out with a tax plan, trying to explain it. Amongst the things he's saying, increase the property tax credit within the state income tax from $200 to $300, starting with the second year in office, creating new targeted relief credits that provide a supplemental credit for households that dedicate 6.5% or more of their income toward property taxes. Essentially, I think, Liz, what the Ned Lamont plan is trying to do is say, we know we've got a problem with property taxes here in the state, and that is one of the biggest, most intractable problems, and he's going to try to get at that.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like he's looking at a statewide property tax is where he sort of wants to go, and I think that'll be an interesting conversation statewide with voters. And, he's going to have to defend his plan. I mean, he's said multiple times that he's going to raise taxes and put tolls on our roads. And I think that that's probably not a winning approach, which I'm thrilled about.
I think Ned Lamont's property tax reform is probably not as grandiose as getting rid of the state income tax. But you could argue that whatever relief you're going to give taxpayers in the state of Connecticut. You're going to have to find that money from somewhere else. And considering the fact that the state faces billions of dollars in deficits, I think both of those are going to be a tough sell.
It means to me that somebody from the Ned Lamont campaign called Bill Curry and said, tell me about the property taxes. It's like Lenny in Of Mice and Men. Tell me about the rabbits. Tell me about the property taxes again. So, I mean, really.
And they spent 2.5 hours on the phone with
right,
Bill.
Exactly.
But and then they understood it.
Short version is, if you want to be fair to people, you really do want to do something about the property tax. Because the property, you lose your job, your income tax payment goes down. You lose your job, your property tax payments on your car, your house, do not change. And so if you're a little old lady whose husband just died and, you know, whatever situation you find yourself in, property taxes is this kind of inflexible hammer pounding away at you irrespective of your circumstances. Your sales tax burden could go down if you spend less money, if you buy fewer things. Your state income tax can go down if you don't make as much money. Property tax is, you know, like the hammer of Thor. It just never lets up.
And both the Republicans and Democrats have been debating that for years with nothing done, saying that we need to have property tax reform.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a couple other issues in the news, including that big casino we were talking about that was going to draw all the people from Connecticut up to Massachusetts. It finally opened. Susan Raff was up there, and she was reporting on it. We'll find out what she thinks about this new casino. Susan Raff from WFSB Channel 3. Liz Karantowicz, our Republican political analyst. Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse.
The Trump administration says lawsuits by environmentalists are holding up logging projects that could reduce the risk of wildfires. But in the West, there's another less high-profile culprit.
The biggest enemy of good forest management, especially fire management, is budget cuts.
I'm Ari Shapiro. An ages-old debate over logging gets rekindled this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen today at 4. Support comes from Land Rover Guilford.
This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. We're on Facebook Live today, so you can see us do a radio show. And the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network, are back with us today as well. We're joined, as always, by Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Our other panelists, Liz Karantowicz, a Republican political analyst, and Susan Raff from WFSB Channel 3. And Susan, you were up covering the opening of the new MGM Casino in Springfield. This is long awaited. There's going to be a big segment about what this is going to mean for the entire region on my show next tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. This has been promised for quite some time. It took quite a long time to build. But the MGM Casino seems to be doing something different than other casinos that have been proposed in the region or in the country, in that it really is built in the middle of a downtown, and it's facing out a bit more so that it's trying to integrate into the streetscape of Springfield, such as it is, with a lot of closed-up storefronts. The hope is that more life comes to the city because of the casino. What do you make of this opening week?
Well, I think you're right. It is unique in a couple of ways. One, it is smoke-free, which is different from all the other casinos. You can only smoke outside, so that's different. But your point that it is downtown Springfield. Now, you know, you have casinos, Atlantic City, but this is not a boardwalk. This is not a strip like Las Vegas. It is right in an urban neighborhood, which I think it seems like a good strategy because you're pulling in downtown. But devil's advocate, you could also say that people may go there on their lunch break, they're walking downtown. So it's not a destination in the sense with the casino. So I wonder the whole gambling aspect. However, I think that the push to have it downtown definitely creates more economic stimulus. And the thing that's interesting about this casino also is that they have more recreational things, not just gambling. They have a bowling alley. They have 7 movie theaters. And you don't have to go and gamble if you just want to go to the casino. You can walk in from the street, walk in, go to the movie theater, and do that with your family. Because I think they're realizing now that not everybody wants to gamble, so now they're widening it.
To be fair, I've got a bowling alley in Winsted, too. But, you know, I mean, it's...
Right. There's a bowling alley at Foxwoods.
There's a bowling alley at
right.
Foxwoods. I mean, I know we're going to draw...
I'm impressed that you know that.
They have an arcade also. Yeah, I mean, I know that, like, what
we
they
did
have
my brother's
the shopping outlets
yeah.
now at Foxwoods and Mohegan. So I think the casinos here in Connecticut have recognized that, too, that, you know, not everybody in their family wants to gamble. Well, and the more recreational or other activities they have, the better.
Well, I think to Susan's point, Colin, I mean, we've talked a lot about how much any state, Massachusetts, Connecticut, or otherwise, should be banking their future on casino gambling. But A, casino gambling is just one of the things that you maybe get out of this. And as we look at the numbers out of MGM, it seems as though they're coming through with a lot of the hiring plans that they said they're going to, as far as how many people from the city they're going to hire, minority workforce, women on the job. I think that most of the benchmarks that they've promised to the city, near as I can tell from what we've covered, they seem to be meeting.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that short term it's going to be really good for Springfield. I mean, the question is, 10 years from now, does it look kind of the way it looks now, but better and more integrated with a lot of other businesses, or does it look like Potterville? And I don't know the answer to that question. I will say, and I should also say that Hartford struggled with this in the 1990s, and Steve Wynn, who also has some interest in Massachusetts these days, Steve Wynn wanted to come into Hartford. And at the time, the exact calculus we're talking about was sort of front and center. As Susan says, there are some social ills that just come along with gambling, with people taking their lunch hours off and having a couple of drinks and going and losing a bunch of money. And you have to figure out, like, how much of that are you willing to tolerate to get tax revenue and ancillary development? Now, one good thing about MGM is that, you know, they are paying essentially property taxes. I think it's pilot fees, but they're paying $17 million that can go up to $26 million. I think there's a community impact float that can expand. You know, Luke Broner would probably take $26 million right now. And so, I mean, that's on top of obviously what they pay the state too. So it's a goose that lays golden eggs. The problem with it is, like all gooses, all geese, they get older, they lay fewer eggs. So 10 years from now, what have you got? You could have like an infertile goose.
And here's what's also different about MGM's facility, that the city of Springfield gets profits not just from slot machines, but also the tables, mm-hmm. the table games. And that's not happening at Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun. It's just on the slots, although it's my understanding with the East Windsor facility, which is not built, they will do both. But that's quite significant. I think that's at 25% of the revenue from slots and the gaming tables.
You know, I wanted to take a break there because there's so much more that we could talk about around that and some other issues we want to get to in the news. But because we've just got a few minutes left in the program, I wanted to go to you, Liz, and I want to talk about John McCain, who we lost over the weekend. Of course, a giant in not just the Republican Party, but in American political life. We've heard an awful lot about how Connecticut Democrats have flocked to John McCain. Many people who are unaffiliated in the state, the largest voting bloc, say John McCain is the sort of Republican I can vote for, the sort of politician I like. I know he's very influential to your political life.
Yeah, it was interesting. When I was in high school and, you know, sort of thinking about what did I want to do when I grew up, I was, you know, really inspired by Senator McCain, and it was his first run for president in 2000. He's partly responsible for my registering as a Republican. He's absolutely influential in my decision to pursue politics as a career. And I don't know that he gets enough credit for his influence in politics and sort of on the mechanical, tactical side. I mean, at the time, he was really a pioneer in using the online platform to campaign. He raised a ton of money through digital efforts, you know, over email and communicating with people online, and he was really a pioneer in that way. So we have him to thank for a lot of where we are and how we communicate. And you know, I was lucky to be sent to Tunisia to do some political training there a couple of years ago, and he was one of the founding principals on that in that organization I was lucky to go with. So, yeah, I mean, to say that he's had an impact on me, but also on most of the people that I've worked with in Connecticut were involved in his campaign. So.
And Colin, I know that you did a program about this on Monday.
Yeah, one thing that I'll say also, just in terms of John McCain here in Connecticut, you know, he's sort of part of a pattern in Connecticut. This could be a fake pattern, but I mean, first of all, as we know, Connecticut is the home of Ralph Nader. Jerry Brown won this state in 92, not Bill Clinton. McCain won this state in 2000. I was with Ben Duval and Chris Healy and all those people who went into Philadelphia. I mean, I was there as a journalist covering them. I wasn't with them. You know, and you could sort of see he had them revved up in a way that really a lot of the Bush supporters in Philly weren't revved up, and they didn't want to give up their signs, and they didn't want to do anything. Yeah. McCain tried to turn them loose, and
true believers.
Yeah, they were like, "Well, we don't want to be turned loose. We want to actually cast a vote for you on the floor." And everybody's going, "No, no, no, you can't do that." So, you know, he does, I think, and you could throw Weicker into this mix. There are certain kinds of politicians who buck the tide, who don't seem terribly answerable to a party establishment, who do very, very well here, and McCain certainly, you know, is part of that.
And makes some fun people to cover too, Susan, as they come through the state, as they're running for president or as they're palling around with Joe Lieberman. These are people who do draw a different sort of attention than the typical Republican, the typical Democrat.
True. And something I learned this week, which I didn't know, our reporter Kevin Hogan actually interviewed Rob Simmons, who was friendly, very friendly, with John McCain, and that John McCain actually lived in New London when he was 4 years old. I had no idea.
So we learned a little something new. Susan Raff, Chief Capital Reporter from WFSB. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Liz Caranowitz, our Republican political analyst. Thank you so much for coming in, Liz.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show. Our show is produced by Scott Brady, with help today from Katie Talarski. This is The Wheelhouse.